From WBUR Boston, this is Here and Now, a daily digest of news and culture.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.
Here and Now is a production of PRI and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, Public Radio's daily podcast of news and culture. This month's desperate search for three climbers lost on Oregon's Mount Hood and this week's discovery of the body of elite climber Charlie Fowler on a mountain in China are reminders of the high cost of that sport. But they also brought to mind a conversation we had last year with adventure writer David Roberts, whose book title hints at his story. It's called On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. By the time he was 22, David Roberts had watched two of his climbing partners die in fatal plunges. He was also on the scene when two other mountaineers, roped together, fell to their deaths. But like most climbers, it didn't deter him. In fact, in 1980, he published a piece for Outside Magazine in which he explained why he kept climbing. The tentative title was Worth the Risk. Well, then a change of heart. As he explained in his book and in our conversation last December, he now asks, worth the risk to whom?
In Moments of Doubt, as that piece ended up being called, I essentially analyzed the question, is it worth the risk, strictly in terms of myself. Do the thrills outweigh the terrors and the losses? But it took me decades to realize that that was too simplistic and even narcissistic a way to go at it. That what I really needed to question was, what is the impact on those left behind, siblings, parents, when someone dies in the mountains? Mm-hmm. And so I actually went back and interviewed certain people who had been deeply hurt by these losses and came to a different, not a simple reversal of my previous conclusion, but I hope a more ambiguous and nuanced conclusion.
Yeah, it certainly is. I'm wondering if you can read us a section from the beginning of the book. When you talk about the death of your first climbing partner, Gabe, you were only 18 years old at the time. Can you set up the scene? Where are you and Gabe? Mm-hmm.
As this passage begins, Gabe and I are two-thirds of the way up at the first Flatiron, which is a 700-foot cliff, but our rope has gotten jammed, creating a terrible dilemma, how to get to the place where it's stuck and unjam it.
Mm. And now are you tied together?
We were originally tied together, but to try to get the rope loose, I untied and flung the rope, hoping to snap it loose. Didn't work. But now we're standing out of sight of each other, trying to figure out what to do. The rope is stuck below him some 60 feet. Mm. And finally he says that he thinks he can climb down to it. Gabe's voice had an unfamiliar, choked urgency. I just got past a hard place, he said, but now it's easier. I guessed that he had climbed to within 25 feet of my shelf of safety. My brain whispered, bring up the rope, Gabe, and we'll be all right. I waited and stared. Far out above the plains, a hawk danced in circles on an updraft, mocking our gravity-bound plight. The sun blazed on my back and neck. A sound I had never heard before seized my ears, yet I knew at once what it was. It was the sound of cloth sliding against rock. Dave! Gabe screamed. Gabe's cry came up to me even as his body accelerated away. No! Oh, no! He began to bounce, the terrible arc of his trajectory longer after each impact. 400 feet below, he sailed upside down through the empty air, hit the cliff head first, and was flung into the treetops at the base of the Flatiron.
Reading that is sickening.
It's hard for me to read.
I imagine.
It's upsetting still.
And yet there were decades when you pushed some of those feelings aside. Can you explain that?
Yeah, one of my chapters is called Hard Man, and it's an old British term from the north of Wales and southern Scotland, a term of total approval for a really good climber who also is very callous to other people's feelings, very self-involved, and therefore capable of climbing when other people are too scared to climb or pushing on in the midst of horrible weather. And I think I became a hard man in my 20s and early 30s by doing that very thing, sealing off the gentler, more introspective side of myself, so that I could climb at the highest level.
And seal off those incidents, well, so that you could climb at the highest level. And after the incident with Gabe, you go on to Harvard, you join the mountaineering club there. You have, you know, terrific climbing experiences, but also another death. A climbing partner, Ed, is there, and then he's not there.
Yeah, we had climbed the hardest climb of our lives, the west face of Mount Huntington in Alaska. And just hours before, all four of us had reached the summit, and we're climbing down as the storm is just beginning to come in. And Ed and I decided to go down first. It's almost pitch dark, and we stopped to set up a rappel on this ledge. Ed is standing right next to me, and to this day I don't really know what happened. But as he leaned back on rappel, suddenly the whole thing failed and he plunged away from me. I saw a spark in the dark, which I think was caused by his crampon skittering on the cliff. And he didn't say a word and fell, I knew, 4,000 feet, so far that he must have fetched up in a basin that we couldn't even climb down to look for his body.
David Roberts, when did it change? When did you start realizing that these things were still with you?
Well, you can't be a hard man forever. I mean, partly you just get, you use up your nine lives. I had too many close calls. And I'm rational enough to realize that I didn't escape them because I was a better climber. I was just lucky. I could have just as easily been me as Ed.
And we should say you're a good climber. I mean, you're acknowledged to be a good climber.
Yeah.
This is climbing.
This is what climbing's about. And also, I think I became more interested in other things. Like getting married made a big difference because Sharon, my wife, not only was not a hard woman and was scared to death of climbing, but she opened up the gentler sides, my capacity for love, which had really been sort of cauterized, I think. Mm. And also I found that I would worry about her worrying about me, which had never bothered me in my early 20s. Mm.
This is when you started realizing about, you know, the other people who were involved when somebody went climbing.
Yeah, 39 years after Gabe's death in the year 2000, I went back to try to find his sister and brother, who were the only surviving members of his family. And what I learned from those encounters was deeply disturbing, but also ultimately hugely valuable. Marion was still in a fury with me 39 years later. She had never understood the accident because the newspapers got it completely garbled, mm-hmm. as they usually do. But she blamed me for it. And the version that had lodged in her head had me as the culprit. Mm-hmm. And as she said, with a curse, she said, "You let Gabe do the dirty work." And it's true, I did. Gabe's father, who was the only effective parent at the time, had been killed in a car accident just 3 months before Gabe was killed. When Gabe got back from his father's funeral service, I said, "Gee, Gabe, I'm really sorry to hear what happened. And the first thing he said, he just blurted out, he said, "That's okay, when can we go climbing again?"
Adventure writer David Roberts, his book, On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. We're going to get Dave's reaction to the recent climbing news in a moment, but last year we asked him about life after giving up the highest peaks.
One of the sad things is I've never found anything that replaced climbing for me.
No. Wait, what do you say? Is it an addiction?
Probably an addiction. But it's also this quest for transcendence, for living a life that's so vivid and vital and dangerous that everything else doesn't matter while you're out there. And I haven't found that even doing wonderful expeditions all over the world of slightly less dangerous kinds.
But are you saying that you have given up the kind of climbing that might leave a widow in its wake? And I'm thinking of Sharon,
well,
your wife.
Yeah, I still do climb. At a modest level and as safely as I can. But climbing's always dangerous. I've had friends who've attempted the same strategy to climb at a mellow level in safe places in their later decades, and mm-hmm. some of them have been killed. But I think I've found a way to do the little climbing I do, so it's just fun and not scaring me to death half the time.
Or scaring your wife to death.
Or scaring Sharon half to death.
It's funny, you come to this recognition that, you know, there are other people affected by what a climber chooses to do. And you say at one point you wish, you know, you'd been a better son to your parents, knowing how they were feeling when you went climbing.
Yeah, I on my very first expedition on Mount McKinley, The seven of us got reported missing and feared dead. And so for a long weekend, 3 days, Mom and Dad figured the chances were that I was dead. And it took me decades again to realize what that must have put them through. In fact, we sort of joked about it. We seven climbers would turn it into a joke later about the Boulder Daily Camera wrote a really corny article about Dad sitting there agonizing, and we would quote lines as if they were jokes from some old melodrama to each other.
And now you realize how he must have felt.
Yeah, and I have much more appreciation for the fact that they never tried to talk me out of climbing, and even after these deaths, they never lectured me or were overprotective. And I asked my mother just the other day why she never tried to get me to stop climbing, and she said, it wouldn't have worked. You'd have done it anyway.
Are you getting criticized by climbers who are saying, hey, you sold out, you've...
Yeah, it's interesting. The strongest reactions I've had have been from other climbers who cannot stand to see their beloved pastime treated this way. I have a very good friend who feels that in his life, that climbing saved his life, that he might have ended up being a bum or a heroin addict without it. And for him, climbing is just an unalloyed good, even though he's had friends die in the mountains.
That's climber Dave Roberts speaking to us last December. His book is called On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. And we have Dave on the line from Utah where he's hiking because we want to get his opinion after the recent climbing tragedy in Oregon and the identification of the body of climber Charlie Fowler in China. The search goes on for Charlie's partner, Christine Boskoff. And Dave, we know you don't want to second guess any of these climbers, but they seem to underscore your point that even the most elite experienced climbers run a risk that may not be worth it to people waiting at the bottom.
Yes, I mean, this happens every year. Very experienced climbers die and disappear, and in some ways when we in the climbing community are not surprised when it happens, even though it's still sort of shocking.
You know, we always hear from climbers after we speak with you or Ed Viesters or other climbers. In fact, we spoke with Ed Viesters recently, and you co-authored a book with him about climbing. He's adamant that the way he climbs and the fact that he is so careful minimizes the risks. In the book, you have a big debate about that. But there are going to be climbers who are adamant in that opinion.
Well, Ed is an extreme rationalist, and he believes that he can almost completely control the risk. And you're right, we did have quite a to and fro about that. But so many of Ed's friends have died that that almost gives the lie to his idea that one can control the risk.
I just want to ask you about some other things we've heard from listeners, again, after reporting on the deaths in Oregon. We've heard from climbers. Rob Meltzer is one from here in Massachusetts who writes that there's a group of climbers who leave instructions, explicit instructions, requesting that they not be rescued because they recognize the risk that they're taking and they don't believe they should jeopardize the lives of potential rescuers. In fact, he wrote me again and said, I wouldn't even put on a locator.
Well, I think that's really admirable, that ethic. I'm not going to risk other people's lives trying to find me. It's totally my responsibility. I think it's interesting in the two recent disasters that the guys on Mount Hood took a cell phone and tried to make a rescue call, whereas Charlie and Christine clearly went off without any backup, no safety net, and were not expecting anybody to even look for them, let alone rescue them.
Right, they didn't tell people pretty much even
where they were going.
Dave, you know, we also hear from the climbers who say it's still safer than crossing the street.
That's nonsense. It's unless you cross the street very dangerously. And it is one of the oldest cliches that climbers use to justify what they're doing.
But what do you say? I mean, you have these, you do have these debates. As we said, you had one with Ed Viesters in the book you both wrote. I'm sure you have them all the time with climbers. Is this just going to be something that is always going to be with us, you know, this debate about whether or not it's worth the risk?
I'm afraid so. And on the evening news, I was disturbed to see at the memorial service of the Mount Hood climber whose body was found that they gave airtime to the very sentiment that I say is of all the cliches, the tritest, quote, at least he died doing what he loved best. I just can't believe that there's any real solace in that for the ones left behind.
Dave Roberts, his book is On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined, a terrific read. Dave, thanks for letting us check in with you.
Thank you, and thanks for rebroadcasting.
And happy hiking.
Okay.
Here and Now is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tune in weekdays at noon for live, up-to-the-minute news from around the world, and visit our website, here-now.org, for more on today's top stories. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.